In fact, he calls me cantankerous. And if there's anybody cantankerous, I've learned it from here. Well, here he comes now. Here comes the cat.
You know, a cantankerous old Irishman isn't really all that funny, I don't believe. All right. Welcome back to the second half hour of The Promise of Tomorrow here on the Science News Radio Network. I'm your host. I'm Colonel Mason. And we're going to speak with Harry Croteau here in a few minutes, where he's going to tell us all about how he learned that he won the Nobel Prize. And, of course, at the end of the program, listener comments and the voice of reason. People tell us that is one of their favorite parts of the show, so I hope you'll stick around for that. And right now, though, let's step over to our fountain of useless information we keep here on the set, rummage around in the coin jar a little bit for today's query.
Welcome to the fountain of useless information. How can I help?
Okay, we have summoned the spirit of the fountain who knows all, hears all, sees all, and tells all for a price. Throw in the coins. And now, O spirit of the fountain, put on your thinking cap or your shower cap or whatever cap you want to put on and tell us. Tundra vegetation surrounds the mouth of the Lena River on which continent? O spirit of the fountain, which continent does tundra vegetation surround the mouth of the Lena River?
I have given you my answer, and now you may tell the other.
Aha! The spirit of the fountain knows. If you guessed the answer to the question, tundra vegetation surrounding the mouth of the Lena River on which continent, if you guessed as I did, Antarctica, we're both wrong. No, it's Asia. All right, now back to our program. Yes, the exciting strains of the Science News Network studio band. All right, as promised, coming up here is our interview with Sir Harry Croteau, where he explains to us about how he learned that he had won the Nobel Prize. Now, those of you who are not quite familiar with the story, Harry Croteau, Bob Curl, and Rick Smalley in 1985 discovered carbon-60. But some of you may know as the Buckyball or the Buckminster Fullerene. And that opened up the world of nanotechnology for us that we have today, where these nanoparticles are used in medicine and structures and just all sorts of different things. Croteau is a fascinating person, Florida State University. He summers in England. And we caught up with him a couple of years ago and had a very nice conversation. And this segment about how he had learned that he won the Nobel Prize has never been aired before. So this is going to be new to you. A little background there about the Buckminster Fullerene and how they won it. There were two students involved with it also, and it has been said that they should have been eligible to win the Nobel Prize too. And that's Jim Heath, who's currently at UCLA. And, of course, Sean O'Brien, who is with Texas Instruments. All of them good friends of this program. So, Bob Curl, funny, when I asked him about how he learned about it, he said he was having breakfast with some friends at his house, and the phone rings, and he told his wife, "I'll get it," and he answers the phone, and it was a reporter. From, I think he said, the Houston Chronicle, said, how do you feel about winning the Nobel Prize? And Bob Curl said, well, he said, I was listening very intently for laughter and snickering in the background, thinking it was a joke. But he said, no, it turned out to not be a joke. It turned out to be real. And Rick Smalley was apparently teaching a class in physics when he got the call, and he announced to the students that he had won the Nobel Prize, and they said that was nice. You know, Curl had gone back to breakfast and said, "I just won the Nobel Prize." And his wife said, "That's nice, dear." And they sat down and finished their breakfast. But, of course, lots of things happened after that. All right, here's Harry Curdo. How did you learn that you won the Nobel Prize?
I learned it on the Internet. I mean, it was a friend of mine said, "Should we wait for the Nobel Prize announcement?" I said, no, I think it's... let's go for lunch, because I reckoned it was going to be a couple of guys whose names began with Z. One of them certainly got it later, and anyway, I was all ready with a photograph of ZZ Tops, and I was going to superimpose their faces on ZZ Tops on their motorbikes. You know, this group with these guys with big beards and stuff like that. Anyway, we went for lunch, and then I forgot all about it. And then my friend said, "Let's go and sort of see what the result is." And so we went in the next room. This is days before, long before email, right? Email was just about starting, and just before the web was set up. And then he sort of screamed and ran out of the room, and he screamed so loudly I couldn't see anything. My vision. And then gradually, as I saw my name in between Bob's and Rick's on the screen, and he came back with a bottle of champagne and said, "I said, what did you buy that for?" He said, "Well, I thought you might win it." I said, "Well, what would you have done if I hadn't?" He said, "We'd have drunk it anyway." And so it was quite a nice event.
Oh, that's a fun story, Harry. Thanks so much for telling us the story here on the program. Now, where were you? Were you in the UK at the time?
Yes, I was in the UK at the time. That's right. It was in my office, or just outside the office in the next room where there was an internet connection. I didn't have an internet connection in my room at the time.
Your office was in Lewes at that time, too?
Yes, it's in Sussex. Well, halfway between Lewes and Brighton. If you've heard of the town of Brighton, which is much better known than Lewes, the University of Sussex is just outside Brighton, on the road between Sussex and between Brighton and Lewes. It's halfway between, and it's a very nice place, just out on the downs, very beautiful part of the world.
And, of course, we wanted to know more about this very beautiful part of the world, where Harry Curdo and his charming wife, Margaret, summer every year in the UK and on the island of England. So we asked him to give us a deeper explanation of it. And this particular segment aired in the summer of 2012.
Well, south of London, during the summer, 3 months, we're based in Europe, particularly in a small town called Lewes, which is famous for several things. The first thing, the first dinosaur fossil recognized was found here.
Oh.
The second thing is that Virginia Woolf committed suicide in the river here. And the third thing, more important for the USA, is Thomas Paine spent several years here developing his radical ideas, which, as you know, were extremely important in the revolution, and his impact on such things as the Bill of Rights, and also his words and writings were used by Washington to spur on the American troops during the War of Independence. So we here in Lewes feel that we made a massive contribution to the birth of the United States of America.
Well, I guess so. Thomas Paine got his ideas when he was in Lewes. Is it L-E-W-I-S or L-O-U-I-S?
L-E-W-E-S.
L-E-W-E-S, went wonderful. And
year-old town, which has steeped in history, and certainly was a place where many radical changes in humanitarian contributions and things like this were made to in Britain, but also to the way democracy was developed in the Western world.
And Virginia Woolf committed suicide in the river there in Lewes, you say?
There's a river. She lived very close to Lewes, which just a couple of miles down the road.
I see. All right. Well, did your wife, Margaret, tell me that before you go back to the Florida State University that you're going to be going to the Balkans?
We've been there. We go there quite regularly, but one is that we'll go to Croatia and Slovenia, and but also to Germany before we go back in about 2 weeks' time to Florida State.
I can understand you're going to Germany. There's such an area of great learning, but I'm kind of surprised about Slovenia and Croatia. What's going on there?
These are very famous places. Croatia is where an institute called Ruđer Bošković was a place of research. Ruđer Bošković was really quite an eminent scientist and was in fact one of the first people to consider something very similar to the chemical bond in chemistry. Fundamental to chemistry is the how atoms stick together, and in the case of Slovenia, Stefan Boltzmann, some of the very famous names in statistics and thermodynamics come from these places. So many countries in Europe have made major contributions to science at a very fundamental level.
The students can access Vega Science, and they can also Google GSET, is that right?
GEOSET, GEOSET. If you Google GEOSET, GEOSET, you will get our websites right at the top, wherever you are in the world. Yeah, it's turned out to be a very good title for this, because we're right at the top and you can see our students making presentations. It's brilliant.
All right, that sounds absolutely brilliant to me. Something else I want to catch up on: when I spoke with you last time, a number of your friends in science were working on splitting water and extracting the hydrogen, and I get asked about that all the time. Are we looking for a hydrogen future for our energy needs?
Oh, it's a big problem. There certainly are a number of people working on these, and I think the big breakthrough still has to be made. I mean, sort of certainly theoretically, it doesn't look impossible, and certainly some people are making progress, but the big breakthrough, which would really ensure that we have sufficient energy in the future to support the level of technology that we now have in place, that's still not there. We're still definitely reliant on fossil fuels for the foreseeable future. And until the big breakthrough, which would be to split water efficiently, is achieved, we certainly are looking to serious problems at some time in the future, because the whole of our society technology is absolutely dependent on the voracious use of energy. The lights, you only have to look at the cars on the road in various cities like Houston and Los Angeles, and then think about it in London and Munich and Delhi and Beijing, and sort of contemplate a future in which the cost of fuel must rise in the end, and must obviously be limited, because we're using roughly a million years worth of fossil fuel every year. I mean, it took a million years to create the fossil fuel that we use in 1 year, and so that's, I mean, very simple arithmetic indicates that that cannot go on forever. There are other problems. A lot of ethanol now is coming from biological sources, and in fact it's reducing the amount of food, that's available, and a quarter of the world is starving. So these sorts of things need to be looked at very carefully. But until the big problem is solved, and I hope it will be solved, but it's proving difficult. But a lot of scientists are really working hard to solve this problem, and the scientific community is taking this problem seriously, much more seriously, I would say, than politicians and other members of society, because I don't think they appreciate just how serious the situation really is. I mean, the oil companies are finding oil here, there, everywhere, but, if we're talking about 5 or 10 years, that's one thing, but if we're talking about 100 years from now, I think we've got big sustainability issues to address.
Well, one of our listeners asked me the other day why we don't use these wind farms and these solar farms to create the electricity to just split water and capture the hydrogen. Why is that not economical?
Well, because there's just not enough energy at the moment. I mean, I think this isn't my area, but I'm just guessing that the wind farms, if you think about them, building one of those things is extremely expensive. One has to work out whether the cost of building one of these windmills, how long it takes to produce the energy that was used to build it. This is the same sort of calculation that is required in the case of fission. When you're talking about nuclear energy, the cost of a nuclear reactor is colossal. You know, they don't grow on trees. The amount of energy involved in the concrete, they're massive amounts of energy required, and they take a long time to actually produce the amount of energy that was required in building them. The wind farms are certainly quite expensive, and I have not looked into this recently, but if they really were very efficient at creating electricity, then I think we would already see that. It looks to me as though it's a debatable issue. But again, I haven't looked at the economics of the situation. With regard to electricity, at the moment, most of the electricity that's produced this way is going into the grid, because, you know, into the electricity grid that we all use, which is certainly probably one efficient way to use it. I'm not the world's expert on these things. I may have a Nobel Prize with Rick and Bob, but we certainly have limitations in our knowledge.
All right. How about putting on the meditation cap for a minute and give us maybe a prediction of the future? It could be fanciful. It could be maybe the World Cup in soccer, or maybe it's something very serious that you really want to drive home. What do you see 5 years out, 10 years, 50 years out? Do you have a prediction for us?
Well, the first thing is that I'm not a predictor. My science has never been what's called strategic. I think it's very important to realize that. I've made three nice contributions. None of these was on a research proposal. They were all puzzled about particular problems. I was puzzled about, as I said, about what was going on in the atmosphere of a carbon star. And it was a very simple experiment, and out of that experiment came this totally unexpected result that we discovered the C60 molecule, which was and the reason that it was some importance is that it was totally unexpected. It changed all our ideas about self-assembly, and it was a fundamental discovery rather than one for applications. I think my main worry with regard to science, and my main looking into the crystal ball, is to try to ensure something that I've already mentioned to you earlier in this program, is that in these days of very expensive research and also the limitations in funding of research, that we do not put all our eggs into the basket of applied or strategic science, okay? We know that energy is the big problem, therefore we certainly have to put a significant amount of our research funding into alternative energy resources. However, my gut reaction is that we've already had a lot of focused research on, say, water splitting. But my guess is that if there is going to be a breakthrough, it might be totally in a totally unexpected area. Let me give you an example. The C60 molecule now has been shown to improve the electricity production in organic solar cells, plastic solar cells. In the future, we expect to see very inexpensive plastic solar cells attached to certain devices, for instance, to replace batteries. Okay? That would be very good, because batteries are really expensive, and you and I know that for every battery that's used, that's used up, at least one or two other batteries just sit there not being used and thrown away long before they've actually, well, they've lost their capacity when they could have been used. So in the future, these plastic solar cells look as though they have some, could be very useful. However, it turns out that in using C60 in these improves the electricity production by an order of magnitude, 5 to 10. Now, C60 was not discovered by a group looking out at how can you improve the electricity production in solar cells. It was produced by us, our group, when we were trying to understand the chemistry in a carbon star. So here's the point that I'm making, that you really do need to have a flexible research program, particularly in the universities, which allows young people, smart young people, to just follow their noses and say, wow, there's something interesting here, what's going on? They will then make unexpected discoveries, which later on can actually be applied somewhere else. The best example I know of this is the following one. Charlie Townes was a physicist, a very eminent physicist, who I think was at Columbia, trying to build a MASER, a microwave amplifier. He was thinking, how can I amplify a signal at very high frequencies, okay, in the microwave range? He built the MASER. Two Nobel Prize winners told him that it won't work, but he continued, he thought it all out, and he made it work. When that microwave amplifier was made, it then led people thinking, how can we make a light amplifier, a laser? 20 years later, the laser is being used in eye surgery.
Sir Harry Croteau, Nobel laureate, speaking to us from the summer home in England. Thank you so much. Always such an honor to have you with us. And that encore segment was aired in the summer of 2012. Stay tuned for the Voice of Reason, but first, and at this time I want to thank you very much for those of you who have contributed to this program. We depend on contributions from listeners like you for the existence of this show. We're totally science community supported. So those of you who have contributed, thank you very much. Those of you who wish to can do so at our website, promiseoftomorrow.biz. On the right-hand side of your screen, you'll see a little tab there for donations. Just click the donations, and we appreciate all your help.
And now, we make time for the Voice of Reason. Listener comments, ideas, and suggestions.
Okay, well, the number one is to think outside the box. Don't do it the way your granddad did. Your grandfather was probably a very smart man, but things change, and you have to adapt with it. So think outside of the box, be willing to make a change and take a challenge. It used to be, for younger people, it used to be that you'd go to work for a utility, you planned on retiring from that utility, like any other organization, you wanted to get your 40-year watch and leave. But now I think the opportunities are out there for a mobilization of our workforce. So that a young engineer, for example, going into the power industry will gain experience and knowledge by changing jobs and enjoying a certain amount of mobility. I'm David Stidham, Senior Vice President and Chief Operating Officer for Trace Amiga.
So you decide, has this really been the Voice of Reason? Listener comments are welcome at 214-329-4949. And please tell us your name and where you're from.
You've been listening to The Promise of Tomorrow with Colonel Mason, the definitive program on emerging and nanotechnologies, now archived and streamed on the web at promiseoftomorrow.biz. Join us next week at the same time as we learn more about the promise of tomorrow.
I am waiting for you.